Welcome to Earth Matters here on Gila Members Community Radio, KURU 89.1 FM. This is Donna Stevens, the Executive Director of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, and I am your host for today's program. On today's show, we're going to be talking about the Dakota Access Pipeline, or DAPL for short, which would bring crude oil across 1,172 miles and four states from the oil-rich Bakken Formation area of North Dakota all the way to Illinois. Since April of 2016, opponents of this project have been camped just outside the Standing Rock Lakota Sioux Reservation. We'll be talking about this issue with Laura Romneres, who recently participated in the Red Warrior DAPL resistance encampment, one of three camps along the Cannonball River. Good morning, Laura.
Good morning, Donna. Thanks for having me here.
So I just wanted to start with some background about this issue, because as we'll be talking about later in the show, there isn't really that much information on the mainstream media. So can you start the show by telling us what is the purpose of the pipeline?
Well, the pipeline, as you said, is 1,172 miles and would stretch from the Bakken Formation, an underground deposit where Montana and North Dakota meet Canada, southeast from North Dakota into South Dakota, Iowa, and Illinois. The project would carry 470,000 barrels of crude oil to refineries and markets each day.
Wow, that's a lot of oil.
It's a lot of oil.
So what is the route? I mean, you said the states it's going to go across, but like what land is it crossing?
Well, in the area near Standing Rock, the planning was originally to go north of Bismarck. And they changed the route due to concerns about water contamination in Bismarck. So instead, they sent it along an area approximately a mile from the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation.
Sounds familiar, like history repeating itself, right?
Yes, it does. Absolutely.
And so how was this pipeline approved?
Well, the Standing Rock Sioux people spoke out against it from the very beginning, and based on concerns for their water supply and sacred sites, and their concerns at every turn were ignored. The water protectors started the first camp, the first resistance camp, when Dakota Access started digging up sacred sites.
So you said water protectors.
Yes. They're using the term protectors. They want to use their own term that's oriented to their intention, not someone else's idea about what is happening there or what their purpose is. Mm-hmm. They are there to protect the water.
Right.
And to protect the sacred sites. So that's the term they use. They don't like to call themselves protesters or, you know, some of the other worse terms that the pro-DAPL people are using.
Yeah, like agitators. They're protectors. They're protecting their water, their land,
exactly.
Their sacred sites.
Yes.
Who is Dakota Access, the pipeline people?
Well, before we get into that, I guess I'd like to say something more about the approval process.
Oh, sure,
if that's okay.
Sure.
The pipeline was approved through the nationwide permit number 12. In little pieces, so they never had to do an environmental impact statement, which if they would have tried to approve the pipeline all at once, the whole pipeline, they would have had to do an environmental impact statement.
Hmm.
And so the nationwide permit number 12 is only intended for if you, say, have a pipeline from a water service facility to a library, that kind of thing. It's really not intended for a 1,200-mile pipeline. So that's the first thing. Also, the Dakota Access Pipeline violates Article 2 of the 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty, which guarantees that the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe shall enjoy the, and I quote, undisturbed use and occupation of their permanent homeland, the Standing Rock Indian Reservation. The U.S. Constitution states that treaties are the supreme law of the land. And yet, every treaty the U.S. government has ever made with indigenous peoples has been broken. Also, the Executive Order 13007 on Protection of Sacred Sites states, in managing federal lands, each executive branch agency shall avoid adversely affecting the physical integrity of such sites. There are historical ceremony sites and burial grounds in the immediate vicinity of the Missouri Crossing. And Dapples should have been denied a permit if they were going to be in compliance with that statute.
So this treaty that you're talking about is still in effect today? I mean, even though it's over 100 years old.
Yes, it's never been superseded. It has never been legally superseded.
Okay. So the pipeline is violating federal law?
Yes.
And this is the Army Corps of Engineers that approved this nationwide permit?
Correct.
And they got around doing the environmental impact statement by just doing it piecemeal?
Absolutely right, yes.
Huh. So who is this company, Dakota Access, that's building the pipeline?
Dakota Access is a limited liability corporation, a project of Energy Transfer Partners. And limited liability is exactly what it sounds like.
Huh.
Dakota Access will not be held accountable for any leaks or any other problems with the pipeline once it's finished, because Dakota Access won't exist after the pipeline is built.
Really? They're just kind of a subsidiary that goes out of business after built the pipeline?
Yes, that's what limited liability means. It's just a temporary structure.
Huh.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Wow. So how is the Dakota Access pipeline funded? I mean, and who are its investors?
There are more than 24 major banks and financial institutions that are helping to finance the Dakota Access Pipeline, including Bank of America, HSBC, UBS, Goldman Sachs, Wells Fargo, JP Morgan Chase, and many others. Together, they have extended a $3.75 billion credit line to Energy Transfer Partners, the parent company of Dakota Access.
Wow, so those are like the major banks in this country.
Yep. It's got big money behind the big oil.
Right. Okay. Well, I guess that's not surprising, right? So who is going to be affected by this pipeline?
Well, all of the landowners and anybody adjacent to the pipeline is going to be affected. The leaks that could happen anywhere along the line will affect everyone.
That will happen. It's just a matter of time.
That will happen.
They always leak. First law of plumbing.
That's
everything
right.
Leaks.
Exactly. It's a great big plumbing project. Yeah, and of course the Standing Rock Sioux people and everyone downstream on the Missouri and Mississippi rivers. Millions of people will be affected, which is another reason why the mainstream media should be covering this. It keeps being portrayed as just this very localized issue, but it really is going to affect a lot of people.
Right.
And there's a Winona LaDuc quote, something that she said about this the issue of the water in this area that I'd like to share with you.
Mm-hmm.
She says, they aren't making any new water in North Dakota, and this is the only water we've got. Same water as when the dinosaurs were here.
Right.
And this is what we're going to need to drink, and our descendants are going to need to drink.
Right. Forever.
Forever. That's it.
So I wanted to ask you about some of the resistance that's going on. I mean, I know that there are several encampments, and I think are they mostly along the Cannonball River? And I also wanted to know, like, how long people have been out there, when this started, and where the camps are.
Okay. All three camps are along the Cannonball River. The first one, I believe, was the Sacred Stone Camp. And the largest of the three is called Red Warrior Camp, or Ocheri Sakowin. And there's an overflow camp that's sort of connected to the Red Warrior Camp that they call the Rosebud Camp. And later I'll tell you about a fourth camp that has just been established as of day before yesterday.
Yeah, a lot of stuff happened over the weekend, and we'll talk about that a little later in the show. I guess what we've neglected to say so far is that the reason I'm interviewing Laura about this issue is that you actually went to one of these camps, and you were there in late September. So you know all about it, which is why we're doing this show today. So
yes.
Something we might have mentioned at the beginning, but never too late. So there's three camps, and they began in April. The first one was established
April
in April.
2016, and they just started with a few people, just a handful of people showed up. Mm-hmm. And they've grown to about, I think there was about 2,000 people in the camps at one time at its peak.
Yeah.
But people are coming and going.
Right.
From all over the world. It's really incredible. And altogether, the last time I heard that they estimate at least 4,000 people have participated in the camps. Nearly 300 tribes are represented. Wow. And most of those are from North and South America, but they come from also from every continent in the world. Indigenous groups from every continent, including, I know Europe isn't really a continent, but also including from Europe. When I was there, the Sami people from Norway were there presenting about their issues. Mm-hmm. And also when I was there, I heard presenters from Ecuador, Kenya, and Canada as well. And the way the camp is set up and these presentations go, it's not like there's a, you know, a schedule made up. People come to the main fire, the sacred fire, and just present to whoever's there at the time. So I'm sure I missed a lot when I was there, sort of coming and going. But it was really incredible, the variety of people.
Uh-huh. So what is it like in the camp?
Well, weapons, drugs, and alcohol are strictly forbidden in the encampments and at the action sites. And pretty much every day that I was there, they made an announcement reinforcing that. They're very, very serious about that.
Mm-hmm.
And once you're there, it's really clear that they're maintaining a strong spiritual orientation there. There's constant drumming throughout the camp, frequent dance and other ceremonies performed at the main fires, speakers from other indigenous nations speaking about their similar struggles in their homelands. So they really want to distinguish what they are doing there from other approaches to resistance, and that this has a very strong spiritual center to it.
Mm-hmm.
And nonviolence. There are workshops on nonviolence that are presented pretty much daily for the newcomers. And they encourage everyone who comes into the camp, even if they're not going to go to the pipeline itself, to participate in those.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to take a short break, and we'll come back to talk some more about this. So we'll be talking about the Dakota Access Pipeline with Laura Romneres after the break, so please stay tuned. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. This is Donna Stevens, director of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, a watershed protection group based in Gila, New Mexico. And we are here in beautiful downtown Silver City in the KURU studios, and I'm talking with Laura Romneres about the Dakota Access Pipeline. And Laura recently returned from the Red Warrior Camp, and so we are talking about her experience there. Right before the break, we were talking about what it's like in the camps. Do you have anything else to add about that, Laura?
Sure, yeah. I was really impressed when I got there that the camp, they have so many people there, and it's enormous, and it's immaculate. Hmm. I couldn't find one speck of garbage anywhere. And, you know, when have you ever been to a campground and not seen a piece of garbage?
Right.
And except there was one day that I was there, that the wind really picked up. And there was stuff starting to fly over the grounds. But then there were also people out there in the, you know, 50-mile-an-hour gusts picking up the garbage as fast as they could. So they're really committed to being on the land in a good way there. They have porta potties all over, so they're sanitated right on top of their sanitation. They're cleaned every single morning. The best porta potty situation I've ever, ever seen, which, you know, can make a difference.
It can make
in
a difference.
An experience. And also, just there was a very welcoming feeling there. And I mean, they've got people coming in and out from all over, so there's a kind of a changing population there.
Right.
And the logistics are pretty nightmarish sometimes, just trying to stay on top of all of that.
Yeah.
But they have several kitchens, they have medical tents, they have a great medical team, you know, just keeping people fed and cared for in all these different ways. They do a great job of that. They have great big water tanks that are set on big flatbed trailers, so everybody has access to fresh, clean water.
Is there somebody or a group of people who are kind of in charge of what's going on and coordinating people and telling them what's going on?
Well, if there is, I never got to know who that was.
Okay.
Yes, I do. There are people who have taken charge of keeping things organized and decision making and all. I, of course, was not a part of those discussions.
Yeah. Okay. So
yeah.
It's not like,
I mean, it's obvious that's happening just because things are being run so well.
Right. So it's a democracy. There isn't like one person laying down the law. We hope.
Yeah. No.
Okay.
No, I don't think that would go over very well.
Probably
in a group
not.
Like
no.
That.
So that's the camps. What are the action sites like? Well, first of all, what is an action site?
Okay. So the camps themselves are not where the pipeline is being built. It's where the people are camping and staying and living. And not all of the people who are staying in the camp go and participate at the prayers and the other actions happening right at the places where the construction is happening.
Okay.
So that line changes as the construction has progressed.
Right.
So that's one thing. And the people that want to participate that way are willing to risk being arrested, because of course people are being arrested.
Right.
They get into the cars and go when those things are happening. And the protectors are unarmed. It's really important to understand that, especially as we continue and start talking about the militarization of the police forces there. They pray and use nonviolent direct actions to slow the construction. And that those actions are also considered spiritual processes or actions.
Okay.
And they're often, there have been a number of times when they have been faced with long police lines and gotten into line, the protectors have gotten into line to greet and shake the hands with each of the police officers, offering them water, sage, and sweetgrass, and trying to show that they're peaceful and saying to them, We're not just doing this for our children. We're doing this for your children.
Right.
And there's a number of film clips of this kind of thing happening there. They're really they don't want to present the idea that they're against anyone. Because if that pipeline is stopped, it will benefit everyone in along that route.
Right. The policemen and their children as well.
Exactly.
So did you go to the action sites?
I did not.
Okay. You were doing more of the support stuff in the camps.
Yeah. I did a lot of chopping of vegetables and washing dishes and picking up garbage and that kind of thing.
Okay. Well, those things are really necessary, too. I mean, that all has to happen sort of when you're creating an impromptu kind of a village or
camp. Yeah. And it's a great opportunity for people who aren't used to it to learn how to work together in groups like that.
Right, right.
So far, approximately 220 people have been arrested at the action sites. And 100 of them, about roughly 100 of them, were just this last Saturday, all at once.
The weekend of the 22nd and 23rd, because we're recording this on the 25th.
Right. So. And Sunday, 2 days ago, the strategy of the protectors took a pretty big turn. So last Sunday, on October 23rd, the water protectors took back unceded territory affirmed in the 1851 Treaty of Fort Laramie as sovereign land under the control of the Ocheti Sakowin, or the Council of Seven Fires, which is their traditional name.
Okay.
Erecting a frontline camp, a fourth camp, of several structures and teepees on Dakota Access property that is identified as Dakota Access property for the pipeline.
Okay.
And this is just east of North Dakota State Highway 1806. The water protectors are calling it Indigenous Eminent Domain. This is a new term that they are introducing into these discussions. And it means that the intention, based on indigenous values, is to restore the land to its natural harmonious state, which is diametrically opposed to the effect of the U.S. government's form of eminent domain.
Right.
As is being experienced with a lot of farmers and other landowners all along the pipeline, I'd just like to point out.
Yeah, so people who have private property along the pipeline, not just this pipeline, but many other pipelines, are having their land seized by eminent domain.
That's correct.
And so the indigenous peoples are trying to take back their land, which, as you pointed out, is actually still theirs.
Yes.
Okay. So I wanted to ask you, Laura, about other places along the pipeline. So we've talked about the camps. And the camps, by the way, are those on private property, or where are the camps? What's the land ownership?
One of the camps, the Sacred Stone Camp, is on private property owned by LaDonna Bravebold Aller. And the largest camp is actually owned by the Army Corps of Engineers.
Interesting.
Interesting.
And do the protectors have permission to be on these sites?
I don't know what process was followed, but they've never been asked to leave.
Okay. Even on the Army Corps of Engineers land?
Correct.
Okay. So I know that...
Not that I'm aware of. I've never heard of any problem with that.
Okay. So I know that some of the places that people are camped on is private property of people who are sympathetic to the cause.
Yes.
Right? Okay. So is there anything else going on in different places along the pipeline besides those action sites you were telling us about?
Yeah, there's an organization called Bold Iowa, which is active in, as you would expect, Iowa. And many people there have been arrested for conducting nonviolent direct action. And another thing I'd like to address, recently there have been some reports of earth-moving equipment in that general area being burned.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of people, because they're hearing more about the encampments around Standing Rock, they're thinking that those burnings happened there, but it's hundreds of miles away.
Okay.
In Iowa where those have occurred. And I know people who are involved with Bold Iowa, and they are also very, very absolutely committed to nonviolence.
Mm-hmm.
And so I know that whoever did burn that machinery, they're a rogue operator or maybe even an agent provocateur. That kind of behavior is absolutely not sanctioned by the leadership in any of these other resistance places.
Yeah, and having an agent provocateur doing that kind of violence, that certainly would not be unprecedented for something like that to happen.
There's a lot of precedent for that in any significant movement,
right?
Social justice or environmental justice movement.
Right. So are there other resistance groups working on this pipeline issue?
Well, there's, you know,
besides Bold Iowa?
I'm not as familiar with the other groups because mm-hmm. I've been so focused on the encampments by Standing Rock.
Okay.
I'm sure they're out there. There was an action that happened several weeks ago where activists shut off the flow of oil for 7 hours.
Yeah. Yeah. And we'll talk about that a little later because I just saw the videos of that, actually. So that's kind of a story in itself. But how has this pipeline issue evolved over time?
Well, there's different issues that have emerged and converged with just this particular pipeline. The resistance efforts near Standing Rock primarily focus on environmental and indigenous rights issues. And, of course, this particular project ties into broader environmental justice and climate concerns issues.
Mm-hmm.
The way that these camps have formed and the attention that they've drawn, the attendance that they have drawn from so many people from so many places has engendered this amazing new level of unity among indigenous peoples who, in some cases, have never, ever gotten along.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They're now coming together and figuring out how to deal with this situation together. They've connected more with indigenous peoples from all over the globe, as I said before.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine that it's likely that those new relationships, those good, strong new relationships, can translate into solidarity when there is something happening in these other locations.
Right.
I think it will increase mutual support on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And also, they've been joined by Black Lives Matter, Muslim Americans, Asian Americans, Hispanic, Latino Americans. And so that has also generated a lot more unity among people of color in this country. And in addition to all of that, there's an increase in the positive connection between the primarily white U.S. environmental movement and indigenous communities. I've thought for a long time that so much more power could be generated for environmental issues in general and especially environmental justice issues if those groups could come together more and work more closely together.
Mm-hmm.
And it appears that that is happening because, of course, there's a lot of non-indigenous people that are showing up at these camps as
right.
well and creating those connections.
Okay. We'll talk some more about that after this short break. I'm talking with Laura Romnerace about the Dakota Access Pipeline, so please stay with us. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. I'm Donna Stevens, Director of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, and your host for today's program. Today I'm joined in the studio by Laura Romnerace, and we are talking about the Dakota Access Pipeline. And Laura has recently returned from the Red Warrior Dakota Access Pipeline resistance encampment, so that's why she knows a lot about this issue. So before the break, Laura, we were talking about how the pipeline issue has evolved over time, and I know you want to add some more about that.
Okay. Well, the actions that they're taking on the ground, in addition to the legal process that the Standing Rock Sioux Nation is in the middle of, which takes time. Of course, people bring up the matter of legality. The Morton County Sheriff Kirschmer is made a point of saying that what they're doing is illegal.
The resistance and encampments, you mean?
The actions on the pipeline itself.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So I would just like to say that laws are funny things. I think we really need them, and they really do help us, but they shift over time.
Right.
It was legal to slaughter the indigenous people and to steal their land to begin with. Slavery was legal. It used to be legal for a man to rape his wife.
Right.
It was illegal for women to vote. And marrying a person of another race was illegal until just a few decades ago. My own parents, who are of different races, were married in that atmosphere. And just till a couple of years ago, it was illegal for same-sex couples to marry. Also, in terms of Native American reality, there was the forced relocation, the movement onto reservations. That was all considered legal.
Right.
The Dawes Act of 1887, the Indian Reorganization Act of 1934, the Indian boarding schools, which did tremendous damage to communities and families and individuals. Those were legal. And all of those had the explicit intent of destroying indigenous communities and their cultures, separating them from their land and their children, and taking their resources for our own use, no matter what harm was caused to them. This is a clear pattern started long ago that has continued to this day uninterrupted. Anybody who thinks it's all in the past hasn't even cracked a history book on that topic.
Yeah, and that sheriff,
Kirshner?
Something like that. Yeah. He apparently said something like, more than five people gathered together is a riot.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
yeah,
huh.
I was definitely going to.
We've all been in riots then, right? I mean, I've had parties with far more than five people there.
Yeah.
So laws can be interpreted however we choose to interpret them.
Yes, exactly. I mean, what is legal is determined by those who have power over others.
Exactly.
And, you know, yes, we need laws, but I think that they should have something to do with what is right and just, and they don't always.
Right.
Sometimes we have to just step back and really think it through when it comes to a situation like this. And I also would like to quote Mark Trahant of Yes Magazine. He said on this topic, the idea of civil disobedience is that there are unjust laws, or in this case, rig laws. There are people willing to go to jail to highlight that injustice. The state lost its moral claim when it moved the pipeline route away from its own capital city to near the Standing Rock Nation.
Right. So we've started talking a little bit about journalists that have been arrested, along with the water protectors. And I know a lot has happened over the last weekend, October 22nd and 23rd. So what's going on with the journalists? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, there's been many journalists arrested for covering the pipeline resistance actions, including, more notably, award-winning documentary filmmaker Dia Schlossberg, who is now facing 45 years on three separate charges for filming an action at a site in Wahala, North Dakota, the one that you described, that you saw the pictures of the people stopping the flow of the oil. That is what she was filming. She was on public land, on a public road, and she did not in any way participate in the action at all. She was just filming it.
But one of her charges was being an accessory to a crime, even though, as you pointed out, she was on public land, on a public road, didn't help them in any way. So, I mean, she just took a picture, right? A video.
Yes. And this is, you know, this is a pattern that's emerging. So, for instance, on September 3rd, Amy Goodman and her team from Democracy Now! Filmed the confrontation between the protectors and the DAPL construction crew that was bulldozing a sacred site. And that coverage went viral with over 4 million views in just a matter of days. Big media picked it up and aired it all over the country. And then, of course, it got spread all over the world. On September 8th, the Morton County Sheriff's Department issued a warrant for her arrest for trespassing. About a month later, on a Friday, Goodman announced that she would turn herself into the sheriff's department the following Monday. Immediately following that announcement, the sheriff dropped the trespassing charge and charged her instead with rioting. And on Monday, the following Monday, the judge dismissed the charge for lack of evidence. Then, a few hours after that dismissal, the sheriff's department said that they were planning on generating some other charges against Goodman. Hmm. Which, since when is that how it's ever done? It's pretty crazy. A number of people have been charged with rioting since then. That turned into kind of a thing.
Right, rioting, which used to be called journalism.
Yes, yeah.
In Amy's case,
anyway. And if you look at the footage, I just dare anyone to look at that and explain to me what looks like a riot. If singing, burning incense, like sage, and praying is a riot, then every church in this country is rioting at least once a week.
Right. Good point. Mm-hmm. So how does this arresting all these journalists, along, of course, with the water protectors, how does this affect freedom of the press?
Well, one of the first things that any repressive regime does is silence the press.
Mm-hmm.
So actions taken now to silence the press should be of concern to anyone who understands the importance of freedom of the press to a healthy, fully functional democracy. Democracy is based on the populace having access to the information necessary to make informed decisions. Even if you are for the pipeline, you should be concerned about this, because what if something you care about and want information about is shielded from your view? What if reporters on that issue are arrested and imprisoned? If it can happen to this group of reporters reporting on this issue, it can happen to anyone. During the civil rights era in this country, it was the images broadcast by mainstream news agencies informing people around the country about what was happening elsewhere that turned the tide against discrimination and towards increased equality. The coverage of the lunch counter sit-ins, the body of Emmett Till, the marches by agricultural workers all made a crucial difference. So let's just take a step back here a little bit and compare how this is being covered versus a recent event, the armed takeover of the Malheur Refuge in Oregon.
Right.
It was a small group of people armed
that
took over a federal property and held it. And they had none of their rhetoric was about nonviolence. They were behaving in a very aggressive, violent manner. And that was all over the news, all the time, 24/7, for however long it took to resolve that. It was weeks.
Right. So I wonder, what is the difference? Is the difference is that corporate interests weren't involved in the Malheur Wildlife Refuge, but this is all about somebody making money?
Well, you know, we can only speculate.
Right.
And also, you know, I mean, that coverage did generate a certain amount of sympathy and gave voice to the concerns of the people who were holding that facility.
Exactly. Yeah.
And Native Americans have never had that kind of advantage.
Right.
And
never
they're clearly not having it now.
Right. Right. Because there really has been kind of a news blackout in the mainstream media, so that if you want to find out anything about this issue, you have to watch alternative media, such as what we have here on KURU, Democracy Now!
Yep.
Those are you have to seek out the news if you want to find out what's going on. So I wanted to ask you, we've talked a little bit about journalists being arrested, and we haven't talked much about water protectors themselves being arrested. And I wanted to ask you, Laura, how the police and the Dakota Access Pipeline security forces have conducted themselves. What have the arrests been like? What has the scene really been like there when people are getting arrested?
Well, the actions are attended by 100 armed officers or more, equipped with assault rifles. They're sporting mine-resistant armored personnel carriers. And
Those tanks?
They look like tanks. They keep saying they're not tanks, but they look like tanks. I guess they're, you know, they're really massive. And,
right.
And they're using this whole way to confront unarmed, nonviolent protectors. Then there is a security force that sicked the dogs on the protectors at the burial site on September 3rd, the same action that Amy Goodman covered and was charged with trespassing over. And that, I'd like to give a little bit of background on that situation. On September 2nd, which was a Friday, the judge denied an injunction to prevent the construction from going over a specific sacred site with burials. And the next day, the construction crew skipped over 20 miles of their route to deliberately dig up these graves that had been identified the day before. It is my understanding, I have been told, that sites like these are often not officially identified by these tribal groups because they do not want people to find out about them and go in and do grave robbing and other forms of desecration, which has happened massively anyway. And so when I was there, somebody had said, well, how did they know that there were grave sites? Nobody had ever said that before, implying that they had just made it up.
Uh-huh.
But they have to do that. They have to just not tell people about those sites. It endangers them.
The Forest Service does that as well. They don't divulge where all the archaeological sites are on the forest.
Interesting. Yeah, it's the same thing.
So when the Dakota Access Pipeline found out where those sites were, they deliberately bulldozed them the next day on a weekend, which presumably is not a work day.
Yes.
And deliberately went ahead 20 miles, as you said, to dig them up on purpose.
Yes. And what happened is that a group of the protectors from the encampment went to that site, you know, after this disappointing ruling, to pray, you know, to offer prayers to the remains of these ancestors, and to their surprise, found this group of people with their bulldozers bulldozing, I heard, 27 grave sites.
Wow. And as I recall, that's a felony, right? So laws are being upheld selectively. We need to take a short break here, and we will come back to talk some more about the Dakota Access Pipeline with Laura Romnerace. Please stay with us. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. I'm Donna Stevens, director of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance and your host for today's show. And joining me here in the studio in beautiful downtown Silver City is Laura Romnerace. And we are talking with Laura about the Dakota Access Pipeline issue. Laura recently returned from going to the Red Warrior Resistance Camp along the Cannonball River, so she's been very involved in this issue. Right before the break, Laura, we were talking about how the police and the Dakota Access Pipeline security forces are conducting themselves when they encounter the water protectors. What else can you tell us about that?
Well, another disturbing trend in how the police are handling this situation is that they've been conducting strip searches on many of the protectors for minor misdemeanors, which is not normally the case for a minor misdemeanor. One 19-year-old woman, the daughter of LaDonna Brave Bull Allard, the owner of the property on which a sacred stone camp is located, was stripped naked in front of three male and one female officers, then taken naked to her jail cell and left there all night. An officer came by periodically saying to her, "Who's your mother?
Huh.
Who's your mother?" Not until the morning did they give her clothing. David Archambault, Standing Rock Tribal Chairman, has been strip searched. The tribal pediatrician, Dr. Sarah Jumping Eagle. Shailene Woodley, the star of the Divergent series. And many more without their visibility or standing.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a misuse of that, clearly. They don't need to be doing that. They're starting to use batons on the unarmed, nonviolent protectors. One woman was sent to the hospital with a broken hand on Saturday, October 22nd. And it seems to me that the police are serving, in effect, as private security for Dakota Access, and not serving to protect the individuals who oppose the pipeline. The actions are conducted peacefully, even when people are locking themselves to machines. They're not hurting people. They're not trying to intimidate local people. But Sheriff Kirschmeyer has projected a message of aggression, saying that the water protectors are aggressive and that they're intimidating local people. There was even one water protector locked down to a piece of equipment, and a farmer fired a shot at him and others with him. Nobody was hit, fortunately, but that's the kind of thing that could increase if the sheriff keeps generating this fear among the local population.
Right.
And if you look at the location of the fracking sites, the refineries and pipelines, you'll see that they are primarily located in or near poor communities of color. I'm kind of launching off in a little bit different direction, if that's okay.
Yes, go ahead.
These are the exact same populations and locations that are given not given the attention by the mainstream media. These places and people are considered sacrifice zones and collateral damage.
Mm-hmm.
The sacrifice deemed necessary for the rest of us to have the things we want in the way we want them. People are trying desperately to protect their water, which is essential to life. They're called protesters, agitators, as if those are terrible things to be. And big oil, which is causing such terrible harm, are portrayed as public servants instead of, in effect, terrorists. We need to be investing in renewables. $3.8 billion that they are spending on that pipeline could go a long ways towards promoting wind and other renewable energy sources in North Dakota.
Right.
I believe this is a pivotal point in the confrontation between the forces of the old paradigm and those striving for environmental justice and a better way to live on this planet.
Yeah, and we should point out, too, in the show that this Dakota Access Pipeline is just one of many, many pipelines and one of many actions that are happening across the country.
Yes, and I think that the way this plays out, the way this pipeline is handled, will give us a clue as to what we can expect in these other situations.
Right, so there's the whole militarization of North Dakota and the police shooting rubber bullets at drones that people
yes.
are using to bear witness to what's happening in the camps and at the actions, and helicopters flying overhead. I mean, if you look at the footage, it looks like a war zone, and we're talking North Dakota, which, as I recall, is one of our 50 states. So it's a pretty bad situation out there. And as we've said many times in the show, the mainstream media isn't really showing this. We talked about Amy Goodman being arrested, Daya Schlossberg. You know, these people are journalists, and you know, inciting a riot just by witnessing what's going on there. Can you tell us a little bit more, something we talked about a little bit earlier about life in the camps? Can you just tell us a little bit more about what it was like there in the camps?
Oh, okay. Well, you know, actually, if it's okay, I'd like to make a suggestion to people who are wanting to go to the camps. A lot
okay.
of people have approached me since I've come back, and I'd like to kind of put the word out
mm-hmm.
a little bit, if that's okay. If you're going to go to the camps, just ask yourself the question, what exactly can I contribute to that effort? They need to train medical people, those experienced in dealing with trauma and other mental health issues, meeting facilitators, and, of course, people who are willing to participate in the direct actions and maybe be arrested if need be. They need people to work in the kitchens, keeping the camp clean, cutting firewood, etc. If you go there, please don't be a tourist or a curiosity
right.
seeker. And if you can't go or don't want to go, maybe consider sponsoring a Native American traveling to the camps. You can go to the GoFundMe.com site and search Sacred Stone Camp, Ochetti Sakowin, or Red Warrior Camp, and you'll see a lot of campaigns by Native people trying to get the money to attend. And if you're a non-Native person attending, please keep in mind they are very welcoming to all people, regardless of skin color or ancestry.
Mm-hmm.
However, a lot of people who aren't used to being in Native spaces aren't, you know, aware of how to conduct themselves. So if you're there, just remember that you're in an Indigenous space as a guest. And so try to be a good one, attentive to and respectful to what your Native hosts tell you.
Mm-hmm.
Attend one of the orientation meetings for the newcomers to the camp. Do not bring weapons of any kind. This is a prayer camp. Do not bring drugs or alcohol into the camp, and yes, that includes prescription marijuana. The last thing they need is someone giving law enforcement an excuse to bring in the drug dogs.
Right.
It's not the job of people there also to educate you on Native issues, history, or culture. Please, before you go, do some homework. Understand that there may be Native-only spaces and events within the camp, and be gracious about that. If you are told to do or not do something according to their tradition, please be respectful and comply. Photography is not allowed during ceremony or prayer. If you're a woman, you are asked not to attend ceremony, including sweat lodges, while you're menstruating. Certain traditional events, items, and clothing are only to be attended, used, or worn by Native people. And please ask before collecting sage, berries, or any other plants from the area. If you're involved with media coverage or taking any kind of photos or video for personal or other use, please check in with the media tent for the media guidelines. And come prepared. Bring your own camping gear, plenty of clothing, etc.
I wanted to ask you, Laura, I mean, it's really good to know that since you were at the camps, you kind of know what the drill is and how people should conduct themselves. I wanted to ask you in our last couple minutes here why this issue is so important to you. Why did you take a week of your own life to go up there, spend your own money to get there and back? Why? What's your motivation?
Well, as a social justice student and a social scientist, I've seen the connections between all of these issues relating to the process of colonization. The forces that have destroyed indigenous communities for over 500 years are exactly the same forces that are harming all human and non-human communities everywhere. Greed and disregard for life and living systems of all kinds, based on the erroneous notion that there is only one right way for humans to live, and that way just happens to require the destruction of healthy human and non-human ecosystems. We've been operating on the notion that climate change cannot be mitigated without the destruction of, in quotes, our way of life. Whose way of life? Human beings managed to live on this planet for hundreds of thousands of years without this level of destruction. Yes, some human communities misbehave themselves out of their means of living. There's examples of that. But the fact is most have not. So that's what drew me.
Yeah.
This is something as a person concerned with social justice issues and environmental issues, I see where these come together, and I would like to somehow contribute to that effort.
Great. Thank you so much, Laura. I really appreciate you coming in today to talk about the Dakota Access Pipeline. That's all we have for today's show. Thank you so much to our audio engineer, Kyle Johnson. If you missed any of today's show or any other Earth Matters programs, you can go to Gila Members Community Radio website and look at the Earth Matters page. We hope you join us again next week for another edition of Earth Matters.